Part 6. No plan survives contact with the enemy. Helmut von Moltke. Storms. The young lieutenant had looked on the point of tears when Savine refused the carriage, but it was far from the first time she had made a man cry. There was no way the damn thing was getting through the chaos on the beach, let alone the chaos getting off the beach, and she was determined to stick close to Leo and make sure her husband suffered no fatal attacks of recklessness in her absence. She had insisted on riding, and that was the end of it. Then the rain came. First a drizzle that beaded the weapons with dew as the first columns of Angland's army marched between the dunes, then a steady shower that turned the proud standards to sodden rags as they struggled inland. Finally, as if the weather was fanatically loyal to King Orso, a pissing deluge that churned the narrow roads to black glue as the unhappy soldiers toiled southwards.
Heave!
An officer roared at a set of men trying vainly to haul a wagon from a quagmire, his wet sword raised as if he was ordering a charge, and the men strained at the filth-caked wheels as the premature darkness of the storm closed in. Savine was so used to proving there was nothing she could not do, she rarely pondered whether there might be things better not attempted. Riding while heavily pregnant at the head of a military campaign mired by foul weather proved to be in that latter category. Her thighs burned with the effort. Her clothes were soaked through and chafing. Her hands were so swollen she had split one riding glove and could hardly feel the reins. Her stomach was sending painful washes of acid up her throat with every jolt of her horse. If she hunched over against the rein, her great beer keg of a belly felt like it would make her aching ribs spring open. If she sat up, she got the storm full in her face, and every step her horse took stabbed her in the spine. And then, in any and every position into which a heavily pregnant human body could be twisted, there was the endlessly throbbing focus of misery that was her bladder. Probably no one would have noticed had she pissed herself. She could hardly have been wetter. Probably she was pissing herself, an agonizing slow leak with every in-breath. When she first became pregnant, she had been pathetically grateful to be free of the menses for a few months. Now, it seemed she had traded the monthly agonies for constant ones. As if to add insult to injury, her husband grinned into the elements, rain coursing down his face, never happier than when he had a simple physical obstacle to manfully wrestle with and heroically overcome.
"Can't let a bit of weather stop us!"
he roared over the wind as he slapped a baffled messenger on the back and sent him to find formations that, for all they knew, had been washed away into the sea.
"Used to northern storms, aren't we?"
he called to a column of bedraggled Anglanders, raising a limp cheer.
"We can manage a Middleland drizzle."
"A drizzle!"
snarled Savine over her shoulder at Zuri, wishing she had taken the carriage when it was offered.
"God punished old Sippet's arrogance with a flood," called Zuri, soaked to the perfect skin herself, but facing the weather with her usual equanimity. "Perhaps he means to do the same to us."
There was a flash on the horizon, claws of trees caught black against the brightness. A moment later, thunder crackled, and a horse reared and dumped one of Leo's aides face first into a hedge. Savine's own mount trembled, shuffled fearfully sideways, and she shushed in its ear, patted its neck, stroked her belly, trying to calm her struggling horse and her kicking baby and the rampaging storm all at once, and wondering who the hell would calm her. She flinched as Antaup spurred his horse up from behind in a shower of mud.
"No sign of Ricca," snapped Leo. "No sign. What the hell's happened to her? If her boats were caught in weather like this, she could be anywhere."
"At the bottom of the sea, maybe,"
grunted Jin, peering up grimly at the streaming skies.
"If this rain gets any heavier,"
growled Savine, trying to unstick her clammy dress from her shoulders under the weight of her waterlogged cloak,
"the bottom of the sea will come to us."
They picked their way around the boggy margins of a vast puddle in the road. One could have described it as a lake without fear of contradiction. Men squatting on an upended cart at one side, like shipwrecked mariners, all manner of gear floating on the rain-pricked water, while others waded past, weapons over their heads, or tried to force their way through the hedges to either side.
"This way!"
They were led past a miserable huddle of men under a tarp and out across a darkened field. It felt good for a moment to move faster than a crawl, even if Savine had no idea where they were moving to. Then she saw flickering lights up ahead, dark shapes moving in the twilight.
"Riders!"
hissed Antaup, ripping his spear from its case. Panic rippled through the knot of officers. Steel scraped as swords were drawn, shields unslung. Savine's horse was barged by another, and she only just clung onto the saddle, wrenching her arm. She stared, heart in her mouth, one hand gripping the reins like death, the other wrapped protectively around her belly.
"Who goes there?"
Jin roared into the night, standing in his stirrups with his great mace ready.
"Lord Isha!"
came a strangled shout.
"And you?"
There was a collective gasp as men sagged in their saddles.
"It's the young lion!"
called Leo, reassuring laughter in his voice.
"No need to piss yourselves!"
"So you say," grunted Savine, squirming in her saddle.
"Thank the fates!"
Riders came smiling into the flickering light cast by the torches of Leo's guards.
"We thought you might be the king's men."
"Likewise."
Leo grinned hugely as he leaned from his saddle to clasp Isha's hand. The sight of their ally gave Savine far less comfort than she might have hoped. He had none of the self-assurance he radiated while stirring trouble in the open council or discussing how they would divide the spoils in Ostenholm. He looked gaunt and jumpy, his uniform a poor fit under his soaked oilskin, his white hair rain-flattened to a dirty grey, but for one absurd tweak, which stuck up like a peacock's crest.
"Barazin is somewhere behind."
Isha waved into the darkness in a way that strongly implied he had no idea where.
"I've had messages from some of the others." "Bloody roads are a bloody shambles,"
snapped a lord with an extravagant breastplate. Savine didn't recognize him, and no one seemed in the mood for introductions, least of all her.
"Lady Wetterlance with us," said Isha,
eyes narrowed against a sudden gust.
"But her troops are strung out along 5 miles of boggy track, and their supplies 5 miles behind that. Have the Northmen landed?"
"Most of them,"
called Jin.
"Stour's somewhere to the east, but half his boat's drifted. In this weather, who knows where they'll wash up?"
"Bloody beaches are a bloody shambles too," grunted Antaup.
"Is Huygen with you?" asked Leo.
Isha's unhappy horse kept trying to turn around. Savine sympathized. He bad-temperedly jerked it back.
"You haven't heard from him?"
"No, but we can't wait. We have to push on, whatever the weather. We can't give Orso any time to gather his forces."
They clattered through the gate of a low farmhouse, mean wooden buildings around a yard of rain-hammered mud, wind thrashing at the trees. A dog ran wild, barking at the horses, and a soldier hissed curses as he kicked it away. Savine peeled herself from the saddle, and Jin helped her down. A family watched from under the dripping eaves of a barn, presumably the unfortunate owners of the place, as dozens of soldiers, wagons, and one heavily pregnant woman crowded into their churned-up farmyard. Probably Savine should have felt sorry for them, but her pity was soluble in heavy rain, apparently, and what she had left she needed for herself. The low-ceilinged front parlour of the house swarmed with men in mismatched uniforms, all gabbling at once, the windows misty with their breath. Antaup had dragged a table into the middle of the room and upended a case of damp maps onto it, rooting through them with the expression of a man trying to solve a riddle in a language he did not speak.
"Damn it!"
Leo held one up to the inadequate lamplight, set flickering as someone shoved the door wide and wind whipped through the room.
"Can we get a decent light in here? Is this map accurate?"
"None of them are bloody accurate."
"We know where the king's forces are,"
grumbled Lord Mustard, rain dripping from his bedraggled eyebrows.
"I heard 2 days' march away." What? We were told he was fleeing south.
Savine winced. In business, few things went entirely to plan. In war, plans and reality barely noticed each other in passing. Panicked guesswork was the best one could hope for. The sheer scale of it. Thousands of men. Tons of supplies. Oceans of misinformation hiding infinitesimal grains of truth. Savine was used to taking charge, but how could anyone take charge of this? Especially someone who could scarcely control her own bladder. Not for the first time, Savine wished Durand was with them. He was the only one of Leo's friends who could really organize, who had an eye for the details, who thought less about what he wanted to do and more about what had to be done. The man was like a wagon's axle. You paid little mind to it when it was there, but take it away, and things plunged rapidly off the road. The door banged open, and another cold draught swept in. A man shook water from a fur-trimmed cloak, huffing and blowing. An old, white-haired Northman, with gold on his mail and rain in his beard and broken veins on his bulbous nose. He looked about, realizing all the soldiers had stopped their business to look at him, and nervously cleared his throat.
"Nice evening for it."
"Hard bread," said Leo, grabbing the old warrior by the hand and giving it a shake fit to tear his arm off. "At last! Where's Ricker?"
"Still in Ulfrith."
"What?"
"Well, she was when I left. She should have left herself by now. Be here soon, I guess. There was a storm. Boats couldn't leave the harbour. Good thing it didn't come an hour later, or we might have all drowned."
Leo had lurched from the heights of relief to the depths of disappointment without taking a breath.
"How many men did you bring?"
"For now, just the ones rowed me here. About 30.
30?
A shocked mutter ran around the room. An officer from Angland and one of the nobleman's retainers had begun shouting at one another. A punch was thrown, they wrestled, barged the table, bellowing insults. Gin grabbed them around their necks and bundled the pair of them out into the night. The clamour and the panic and the wild eyes reminded Savine too much of Valbec. She felt that horribly familiar sour taste, the gorge rising in her throat, her heart thudding and her head spinning as she backed into the shadows, wondering if among all these half-glimpsed faces she could see the men who had chased her through the streets.
"Are you all right?" asked Ciri, taking her gently by the elbow. "Never mind Ricker," Savine forced through her gritted teeth. "Just find me a fucking bucket." "This way," said Ciri, slipping through the madness to a side door.
Savine shuffled after her, one hand pressed into her back and the other under her swollen belly, into a little kitchen on the side of the building with a time-blackened fireplace and a smell of bad cooking. She pushed the door shut and leaned back on it, tried to ignore the mad babble of raised voices from beyond, fix on the rattling of the ill-fitting window, the steady drip-drip of water from a leak. Ciri stood with hands on hips, looking down at a pair of empty milking pails, yoke still attached and propped on top.
"More than adequate," said Savine, waddling over.
After much fumbling, she finally wriggled her drawers past her knees, and with Ciri half holding her up, managed to squat over one of the pails, skirts gathered around her hips and the cold metal brushing her arse. When she heard the metallic spattering, she almost cried with relief. She shuddered at the last trickle, tried to bend down to fish up her drawers between two fingers, but could not quite reach.
"Hell!"
she gasped, legs trembling with the effort. In the end, she had to stand before she fell, let Ciri drag her rain-sodden skirts out of the way and pull them up for her. She flopped back, exhausted, onto a stool, with a flapping of muddy cloth, shoulders against the damp plaster, boots stretched out wide in front of her.
"So much for leading an army. I can hardly get my drawers up without help."
"A good thing for your reputation as a general that I am here," said Ciri. "Rabik and Harun should be along soon, with dry clothes and dinner." Savine shut her eyes, tears of gratitude prickling the lids.
"What the hell would I do without your family? I've no idea how you can stay so calm." "I was not always a lady's companion. I have seen my share of storms."
Zuri frowned off into the corner of the room as though bad memories lurked there.
"They pass in time. If the lightning doesn't find you out," muttered Savine, giving Zuri's hand a squeeze.
The door rattled at a thudding knock, and she gritted her teeth and worked her way into a slightly more presentable position, bladder aching again already.
"Yes?"
The door wobbled open, and someone dipped his head under the low lintel.
"Broad!"
The name almost came as a gasp of relief. Here was a man she had seen deal with a crisis, a rock to cling to in a storm.
"Lady Savine."
He frowned down at her, eye lenses dotted with beads of rain and an ugly scab on one side of his head.
"Are you all right?"
"I should not have ridden, and it should not have rained. Tell me you have some good news."
He did not look like a man with good news, it had to be said. Even in Valbec, during the uprising, even when things got bad, he had always seemed hopeful, at least. Now he looked grim, brows wrinkled, fists clenched. For a moment, the sight of him, scabbed head nearly brushing the low ceiling, gave Savine the slightest twinge of fear, an echo of the terror when she first saw his great silhouette on the barricade in Valbec.
"The breakers will join us," he said after a pause, "and the burners. They've been armed, like you told me, aiming for uprisings all across the Union on the last day of summer."
"They should already be underway," murmured Zuri. "That could make all the difference."
Savine closed her eyes and breathed a long sigh.
"If they can pin down the King's Own, stop reinforcements arriving, we might not need to fight at all."
She hoped, she prayed they did not need to fight at all.
"Who did you deal with, Rissenau?"
"No."
Broad took off his lenses to wipe them on a corner of his shirt. Savine got the feeling it was definitely bad news this time.
"Judge."
"The woman who hanged all those people in Valbec."
Broad winced, mouth open, as though wondering how much to say. In the end, all he said was,
"That's her."
Savine felt another surge of panic, slipped the box out of her sleeve and into her trembling hand, snapped it open. Water had got inside, the pearl dust made useless paste.
"Damn it!"
she snarled, flinging it against the wall. Right away she felt foolish.
"Sorry, not very graceful."
"These aren't very graceful times."
"Can this woman judge be trusted?"
"I'd sooner trust a scorpion,"
said Broad, hooking his lenses around his ears again.
"We'll just have to hope for the best."
Savine gave a little gasp as her baby shifted, put a calming hand on her stomach.
"Is war always like this?"
"It's when the enemy arrives things really turn to shit, begging your pardon."
"Let's hope they never arrive then," said Savine.
"Hope can't hurt."
But Broad gave the strong impression that he did not think it would help much either.
"Could you tell His Grace what you've told me?"
"Aye, if I can get a word in."
Savine waved Zuri over.
"I fear I need my bucket again."